and welcome back to Batman Nightcast, a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network, covering the legends of the Dark Knight across the decades. I'm one of your hosts, Chris Franklin.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
In this episode, we're going to discuss two classic short Batman tales and listener feedback. In fact, both of these stories we're going to cover are so classic, they made it into the late 1988 version, the first edition of the greatest Batman stories ever told hardcover, which is where I first read them. So, Ryan, when did you first encounter the Batman nobody knows and there's no hope in Crime Alley?
Also in the greatest Batman stories ever told, but this is the paperback edition that I got with the Walt Simonson cover that I got probably 1990. The same volume, just the paperback version.
Right, yeah, I got that for Christmas of 1988. I got the greatest Batman stories ever told hardcover book, and it is beat to death. luckily, I found one at a convention for like really cheap. I think that book normally is fairly pricey, the hardcover nowadays. But
yeah,
and right. I have the same soft cover. I read that one now because I beat the other one to death so much. But yeah, I mean I love that book. That was such a great book. I can't tell you how many times I've read that over the years. And again, these two stories were selected by a panel of Batman experts as two of the greatest stories ever told up to that point. So I think we're in good territory for this episode.
I think so. I think, yeah. And again, I think we're going to spend a lot of this time talking about, one, the Superman movie that just came out. And you're welcome, world, because certainly I think we did our fair share to make that movie a success.
I think so, too. Yeah. Thanks. You're then, welcome, Zaslav. Yeah.
And then the feedback for the last five episodes. But yeah, we did want some brand new Batman content for this episode. So we went with two old stories for our new content.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And we'll talk about what we're going to do moving forward. But this time we thought we'd just go all, as Rob would say, classic.
Classic. You
know, classic. Yeah, put that extra A in there somewhere. Classic. So speaking of Superman, I know we did a separate episode of Superman Movie Minute where, you know, several of us, including us two and Rob and several of our friends talked about the Superman movie, several of the FW All-Stars. But just for folks who, for shame, didn't listen to that episode but have been listening to Nightcast, we should probably discuss what our thoughts were on the Superman film. So what were your overall thoughts on the film, Ryan?
I really, really, really enjoy it. It's a great movie. It's a fun movie. You know, by now I've seen both Superman and Fantastic Four. I was looking forward to both of them for different reasons, and kind of had different emotional responses to them. And I'll mention the Fantastic Four one in a little bit, but in terms of Superman, it was so much of what I wanted, what I feel like a lot of Superman fans have been asking for. I think you can certainly look at it as a more aggressive, borderline hostile reaction to the previous incarnation with the Zack Snyder version of Superman in that DC Universe version. I wanted to say, you know, they could be diplomatic, and we could say they all kind of exist in the same universe and everything like that. Certainly, though, when James Gunn has literal rage monkeys flooding the internet with anti-Superman comments, it's like, I feel like he's kind of anti-review bombing this movie just with that, like basically, like he's already creating the memes that will counter the people who are going to complain about this movie. I loved the tone. It was fun. It was upbeat. It felt relevant and optimistic and hopeful in a world that isn't always that way. And I think we maybe mentioned this on one of our previous episodes when, I don't remember if it was when we were talking to Michael Bailey or maybe Dr. Ange or something, but of all people, Kevin Smith was kind of saying that Superman seems to resonate the most with the popular consciousness when times are hardest, when the country isn't feeling particularly happy with what's going on with the direction of society, and it's a lot more cynical. That's when it seems like the Superman beacon shines brightest, and it kind of the pinnacle of what he represents seems to resonate people because it's that hope, that wish fulfillment. And I think that certainly feels true today and apt. And I know a lot of people who saw the movie kind of came away with that impression, like, yeah, this is what we needed right now. This was this was a Superman and just general spirit that has been lacking for a while. So yeah, overall, I enjoyed it. We can get more into the details, but big picture, love the spirit of the movie, love the tone and the feeling that I came away with.
Yeah, same here. I co-sign all of that. I've seen it twice. I wanted to see it again, and now I guess I could rent it on digital, which I know is a bit controversial that it hit so early and people are questioning why did they do that? It was successful, but apparently that's just the model of how movies are distributed is changing, and it's my understanding is that Warner Brothers wants to get as much. They've already advertised it. The
Right.
advertisements are still fresh in people's minds, so they want to get it out there for, people that aren't willing to go to the theater. Well, by golly, we advertise it, so now you can watch it this way. So
Right.
I still hope I can find it in another theater. It's starting to kind of dry up, I think, but I'd like to see it again and like to see, I've only seen Fantastic Four once. I'd like to see Fantastic Four again. But yeah, I mean, I loved it. I think they nailed the character. That's the version of the character I want to see. I thought, I love that Gunn embraced, again, we've said this a million times, but the fact that Superman refers to his robots as Superman robots,
Robots,
just a little goofy thing like that, and saving the squirrel and all that stuff is just it's almost like I just the Huey Lewis song "It's Hip to Be Square" just popped in my head, because I mean that's basically Superman's this kind of square goofball, but he's so earnest.
That's the new rock and roll.
That's the new he's the new punk rock, right?
He's the new punk rock,
He's so earnest, and that's what we and I agree completely. That's I think you're right. I mean, in the post Watergate 70s and post Vietnam, we had Christopher Reeve, and in this awful times we're living in, we have David Corn Sweat and James Gunn. Version we had Richard Donner and Christopher Reeve. Now we have James Gunn and David Corn Sweat. And I think yeah, I think exactly. We really do. We don't need a don't want to get on that and bash the people. Those movies have their fans, obviously. And I there's aspects of the Snyderverse movies that I don't that I like. There's none of it I really love. There's stuff it's okay, but idea yeah, this was a breath of fresh air. Like we've said, it's the most of comic booky of comic book movies in many ways. I pretty much like there were just a few minor niggles I brought up that, and over time, I don't even care about those, the little things that bothered me. It's like that doesn't matter. And I will report. I got to go. I've been before, but I got to go to the Cincinnati Museum Center / Union Terminal. Used to be Union Terminal building, which is the, of course, the inspiration for the Hall of Justice in the Superfriends cartoon, and they filmed parts of the movie there. The scenes with the Justice Gang
And then.
were actually filmed there, so that was cool to be back in that building. And like, oh well, there's the curb where Lois's car was, and here's where Guy Gardner and Hot Girl were sitting. And the mural they replaced with the superhero mural, which thankfully James Gunn released the whole mural, so now we can all know who all those characters were. But it
So
was
yeah,
just,
now we know who the characters on the mural are. We just don't know why those characters.
Yeah, why Madame Xanadu with the weird veil on her head, and
It's like,
why Max Mercury twice, and
yeah,
things
it's
like
like,
that. Yeah.
okay, are we expecting an Atomic Knight movie sometime in the next couple of in those future?
I didn't even know who Ghost of Flanders was. I mean,
Oh,
okay,
for
I
real?
and I consider myself a DC historian, and I had no idea who that was. But yeah, I mean, it was cool to be back in that space, and it seems like they've really embraced it. They've got a sign up. It's just like, meanwhile, blah blah blah, and it shows the building, and it's really cool. But yeah, I loved it. I saw several families there with Superman shirts. And they knew, that's why they came. So it's like that, it was the parents with the kids, and I know you said Reese was a big fan of it,
He
and
loved it. Yeah.
yeah,
He
that
wants to be crypto when he grows up. We'll figure that out.
who
We'll
doesn't, right?
work out the logistics of that.
Well, and it sounds like James Gunn's writing a Superman family film.
Something like,
Yeah, that's got it's not a Superman sequel per se, but I guess maybe it's kind of a sequel to both Superman and Supergirl.
Could be,
So that's great. I mean, I'm guessing the success of this Warners was like, we need more
We
now,
need
you know.
more. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So yeah, I loved it. It's and again, I agree with everything you said, and I feel like I'm really excited to see where they go forward with this character, and I really hope we get to see Superman fight Brainiac in space.
We
I
have
just
to.
I,
We have to.
David Cornsweet beat the hell out of some Brainiac robots. You know, I can't, I can't, I will squeal like a little schoolgirl if we get to see
I
that.
don't remember if it was if this came from you or if somebody else was mentioning it, but I heard somebody fan casting Brainiac and mentioned David Batista, Drax, from which I was kind of like, okay, he's much more of a physical thing, but if you actually think about it, like he's not as much anymore. He has slimmed down a lot. He's still a physical action star thing, but he's not like this jacked, super like ripped type of guy like now. He's like he's lost a lot of weight and he kind of has a different he projects a little bit of a different energy now. And it was like that would be an interesting take for Brainiac. I don't dislike that. It would be very interesting. So
Yeah, that makes sense. It wasn't me, but I like that because, you know, you think of how Drax is so literal, that can clearly, you know, go into the coldly logical Brainiac, and plus he's green, so you know,
Yeah, he is
you're probably like, I don't
involved.
want to be green again. Can we make me the animated series blue, you know, the teal or whatever, you know?
And Batista played a replicant in Blade Runner 2049, so that that's
That's right. Yeah, that's a good pick. I hadn't really like tried to fan cast
I haven't either. I
Brainiac.
haven't projected that far out, but like when I first saw that, I was like, that's what you're going with? And then I like when I kind of listened to their explanation, I'm like, huh, all right. You might have won me over on that one.
Yeah, nothing against Chris Pratt, but he's in everything, and I don't want him to be Brainiac. So, you know, of the Guardians actors, I'd take Batista. Yeah. So, and Bradley Cooper's already Jor-El, so you can't use him. So.
As I was coming, I did end up seeing Superman a second time. I took Reese to see the IMAX preview screening that first week that it came out. And that was a very fun experience because we had to go out of town for it. And we went to a Dairy Queen because he really wanted the Dairy Queen Superman ice cream thing, which I was like, yeah, it's just their cotton candy ice cream, I think, or their birthday cake ice cream. But he loved it. So, and then we went to the movie. And there was this whole thing, and I kind of talked to you guys about this, where like my particular IMAX before the movie screened two horror movie trailers back to back, like The Conjuring and Weapons, and these were freaky jump scare trailers. And like I was like, okay, I know it's a 7 o'clock show. That's IMAX thing. They're not necessarily catering this to a little 8-year-old kid, but I was like, this is kind of harsh. And like even after, like I told him, I was like, you can look away if this is bothering you, and he did. And then even after the movie, when we were walking back to the car, and I was like, how did you like Superman? He's like, yeah, it was great. He's like, I didn't expect them to show those horror movies during the. I was like, I didn't expect that either. He's like, I hope I don't have bad dreams tonight. I'm like, oh my God, this IMAX theater scarred my kid with these trailers that I didn't. But he didn't think about that again. He loved the movie. And then when we've been a few weeks ago, when we went back home to see my parents out in the Midwest, they wanted to see the movie again. Like my dad mentioned seeing Superman. I'm like, you've never shown any interest in this like type of like world. These like you don't like genre films or science fiction stories and anything like that. I was like, I didn't even surprise he knows who Superman is. Now, ironically, his father, my grandfather, his favorite TV show of all time apparently was Wonder Woman. Now, I don't know if that's like a geek culture thing or if that's just an old man who likes Linda Carter Wonder Woman, which who doesn't? I don't know if that gives him nerd credit or if that's just like that's what you were into in the 70s because that was there. Because he also apparently liked Charlie's Angels. Okay, this isn't so much a comic book thing. There's a different theme here that
What
grandpa
they called
liked.
that jiggle TV back then, right? Yeah, I think that's what they called it.
But yeah, they like the movie, so I think it kind of yeah, it is a multi-generational movie that appeals to lots of different hardcore fans and neophytes. The other thing that I wanted to touch upon briefly before we get into the Batman of it all, but the Fantastic Four thing, I kind of mentioned like of the two of the movies, I should have been looking forward to Fantastic Four more. Fantastic Four is like my favorite Marvel property, my favorite kind of collective like thing in Marvel. And Superman, I love Superman, but he's not the top of DC for me. But I had this kind of growing unease as we were getting towards the movies, and it was sort of confirmed by my feelings when I walked out of the theater. It was that I didn't know what to describe it when I left Fantastic Four, but ultimately I realized it was a feeling of bittersweet. This was the Fantastic Four movie I have wanted for 20 or 25 years. Like this had so much of what I always wanted in a Fantastic Four movie. Not everything, but so much like was there that I wanted. But it might have been a little bit too late because at this point I am really checked out of the MCU. I haven't seen the last couple of MCU movies. I haven't seen a bunch of the MCU TV shows on Disney Plus. When it flashed at the end, the Fantastic Four will be back in Avengers Doomsday. I'm like, okay, I don't really care. I'm not looking forward to these things. And I just like, this was a great movie. Why couldn't this movie have come out in 2007 or 2008 or 9 or something and been, at the front of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and help build the foundation the way the Fantastic Four did, the way they were supposed to? And instead, they're kind of like an afterthought. And I was just feeling like, okay, I got the FF movie I've wanted. And it felt sort of like now I can close the book on that. That chapter is over. I can close that book on that. So I just left with these two very opposing feelings where Superman felt hopeful. Superman felt like a beginning for me. This is opening up the DC universe of movies that they can do. Like, how are they going to do Supergirl? How are they going to introduce Wonder Woman and Batman within this world? What other weird crap is James Gunn going to throw at us? Because you know he will. And Fantastic Four was just kind of like a bookend. I was like, I'm glad that I finally got to see that, but it was an ending to something. So yeah, it's just like kind of that bittersweet feeling. It was just like, all right.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah, I mean, I haven't watched Ironheart. I think I've seen everything else, but I haven't got around to watching that yet. But I'm not as invested. I think honestly, my kids keep me more invested because they're still invested in the MCU, and I think they kind of, they send me things. Oh, look at this and that, and so I think that's one reason why I'm a little more into it. So. But I do understand it does. It did feel. I kind of get that. It felt like, yeah, this is. Could we? I mean, there's things about the Tim Story movies which are fine. I like. They're fun. But I don't hate them because Andrew loved them when he was a kid. But yeah, it's like yeah. This was much definitely the better version, obviously. But it. I walked away thinking. I was. I think. Well, some people were saying. Our friends that saw it a little bit before me were like, I like this just as much as Superman, maybe a little better. And I'm like, oh, I doubt I'll feel that way. But honestly, I mean, as much as I love Superman, I kind of feel like Fantastic Four, Superman was like you said, I think it was appealing to all people, and so it's got a lot crammed in there. I think it's done very well. I think Fantastic Four is a better linear story, I mean, it doesn't try to
I can
take a
see.
huge as big of a bite because it doesn't have to, right? It's off in a pocket of the MCU, but it's still in the MCU. So it's more just concerned with focusing on the character, the story of those characters. I do. I didn't feel like that the movie was chopped up or edited, but now that I know they cut so much out of it, I'm like, oh, I want that extended cut bad.
Yeah, no, I certainly do.
Yeah, I want to see the Red Ghost and John. They cut John Malkovich completely out of the film. I'm like, that's ballsy, Jeez, I wonder how he felt about that. But I'm sure he's been cut out of movies before. But still, yeah. But no, I didn't. I thought the look and the feel of the film was perfect. I didn't. I thought, okay, I like Pedro Pascal. I like him as an actor. He seems like a cool guy. And I thought, okay, I'm probably just going to feel like I'm watching Pedro in this movie in an FF suit. But I really did buy him as Reed. That was the thing I didn't think I was going to completely buy into, but I did. And I bought them as the characters, everybody. I thought, and Vanessa Kirby's Sue was, of course,
Amazing,
is she is the awesome, kick-ass hero of that film. And I love that, and it was great to see that. And yeah, I really want to see it again. I was hoping to see it I was a little frustrated. We took Danny back to school yesterday, and I thought for sure that the theater in that town would be showing it. They've already, it's not in the theater anymore. It's like there's six screens, and they're still showing Jurassic World that came out like almost 3 or 4, almost a month before that.
That's already on digital. You
I
can like buy and
know.
rent that. That's
I know. It's like I thought for sure we'd get to go see Fantastic Four yesterday, and we didn't. I was like, dadnabbit. So I'm gonna have to sneak back in. I've only seen it once. I'm gonna have to sneak
man.
back into a theater before it hits digital, and I don't know when it's supposed to come out. But I hate too that one thing I do hate is the MCU fatigue is real, because obviously it did very well the opening weekend, but then it dropped off a lot in subsequent weeks. So it's like, I think a lot of people are where you're at. It's like there's too much homework. You feel like you've got to watch too much stuff to keep up. There's too many of the main characters off the table now, the main actors, you got connected with, or I know RDJ's coming back, but he's coming back as Dr. Doom, but you've got him, Chris Evans, and Scarlett Johansson off the table, as their characters. So I think they just lost a lot of people. A lot of people seem hyped about it, this new Spider-Man movie that they're filming out in broad daylight, which looks fantastic,
We'll see where that goes.
yeah.
Yeah, I had a lot invested in what they would do with Reed. And overall, I really liked his portrayal. There were a few moments where I was like, I'm watching Pedro. There were a few moments where he took me out of it. But overall, I really, really enjoyed that. I didn't know anything about Vanessa Kirby. I hadn't seen her anything. I thought she was amazing. I mean, the story was very much her story. And if you see that, you understand what I mean. And she was a rock. She was awesome. Joseph Quinn as Johnny really impressed me because Johnny, I think, is the character that's easy to just take for granted because he's like, if there was going to be a character that's all flash, no substance, it would be Johnny Storm. But he was actually really, really cool, and he had his own cool little subplot, and he impressed me. I love Eben Moss Bachrach, the guy who played Ben Grimm, who played the Thing, and he was good for what they gave him. I do think that character was underserved a little bit, like didn't have as much to do except for his weird sort of flirtation with Natasha Lyonne, who was a weird casting choice for this kind of nothing character. It was like you were wasting a great actress on this little part and everything. But the other thing was like the action piece in the middle when they go to the other planet and they meet Galactus for the first time when they're in his ship, and then the chase when they're being like when they're trying to escape and they're being chased by the Silver Surfer, and then the whole thing with the black hole as Sue is going to the labor, that whole extended like 10 minutes might be my favorite thing in a Marvel movie in a long time, if not ever. Like that whole sequence blew me away. So yeah, when I say there was a bittersweet quality, there was still a lot about this movie that I loved and I was so glad to see. I like it was something that I could check that off my bucket list. I got that amazing sequence that I wanted to.
Yeah, that sequence was a very that was a nail biter. It was like, oh, what's gonna happen? And spoiler warning, one of my favorite parts was when she's like Sue tells Johnny, kill her, Johnny.
Kill her.
It's like, wow, okay. It's like, yeah, you would like kill this. She already threatened Earth. She's trying to get your baby. Kill that bitch, and it reminded me of the scene in The Incredibles when Elastigirl, Mrs. Incredibles, piloting the plane with the kids on it, and the missiles come at her, and she's like, abort, 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 and the plane blows up, and they all come out, and it's like that was like the most nail biting like thing in an animated Disney movie I ever seen in my life, like, oh my God, so I mean, it kind of felt like that, oddly enough, The Incredibles. Maybe it was the Michael Giacchino score, I don't know, but which I love that score, great score.
Or it could be that this was true to the spirit of the Fantastic Four, and The Incredibles is also true to the spirit of Fantastic Four.
Yeah, I love one of the little thing was right before it come out. It was like so and so says it's like a live action Incredibles. I'm like, ah, that's like the cart leading the horse,
Yeah,
but
exactly.
yeah, okay, yeah, but no, I loved it. I hope Avengers Doomsday is the huge comeback of the MCU, that they it makes a crap ton of money, and so we can get more movies of these other characters, because I think Thunderbolts slash New Avengers was great. I really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed Fantastic Four more, but I thought it was a great movie. I think they are back on track, but I mean, unfortunately, it looks like they've got a lot to prove to get back to where they were. And I don't know if they'll ever get back to where they were because, movie theaters, it's post-COVID, they just don't make that much money like they used to. So I don't know if it's possible, but we'll see. But I hope that it's successful enough that we get another Fantastic Four movie. And I kind of want them to go back to their world and be in that world because I like that world better. Especially with the world we're living in now, I like that world better, right? Yeah, so
No, no kidding. No kidding. Yeah. All right. Well, we've talked about everything except for Batman.
Right. Oh, well, we can mention that they actually are apparently going to film The Batman too, right? So apparently that's actually going to happen. So I at one point I was like, I don't think that's ever going to happen. And I guess it is now. So maybe.
I kind of love James Gunn is so willing to engage with fans and critics and like about like certain like questions. Like they'll just like randomly, hey James Gunn, are you gonna do this? And he'll like just respond to nobody, like, yeah or no, or something like that. And I saw something like, yeah, like the new Batman sequel or whatever is going to introduce Robin or something like that, and there's gonna be this whole kind of like thing or whatever. And James Gunn just responded, there are five people who have read the script for the Batman 2. You're not one of them. You don't know what you're talking about.
That's funny. Yeah, I mean, I know there's all this speculation. Oh, he's going to introduce Robin. It's like that's it's like, well, how do you know that? I mean, yeah. The movie ended with I could the way the movie ended with Batman figuring out he can be a symbol of hope as well as vengeance. It makes sense that he would have a Robin. Okay, I kind of want him to introduce Robin too, but it's like doesn't mean they're going to. So we'll see. But yeah, I'm just glad to see they're actually moving forward with that. So okay, so let's actually talk about Batman on this Batman podcast. And we're going to start out with the Batman nobody knows because you might actually, we may have forgotten Batman, so we might not know him because we're talking about everything else. But no, this came from Batman number 250, which was cover dated July 1973. And it is a story by Frank Robbins and Dick Giordano. In this tale, Bruce Wayne takes three underprivileged kids camping in the woods the way single millionaires often do. The exotic sounds of a woodland creature startles one of the boys who is certain it's Batman. The boy tells the others that Batman is an inhuman monster as big as Gotham City, able to fly, shrink, and phase through walls. He has X-ray vision and bulletproof skin. One of the other boys believes that Batman is a blaxploitation hero who uses a jetpack and high-tech gadgets to fight crime. The third boy's version of Batman is 10 feet tall with giant bat ears and the ability to fly. Unseen by the kids, Bruce Wayne dons his costume and reveals to them what Batman really looks like. Except the kids know it's Bruce and they don't think the costume is real or scary enough, so they go to sleep. The end. So what do you think about this one, Ryan?
It's a 5-page story. It's fun. I dare say it's a little bit cartoonish, and you can probably address that in a little bit if you want.
I will.
For one thing, for any of those listening, I don't believe Batman issue 250 is on DC Unlimited or Digital Unlimited. What is it called? That's Marvel Unlimited.
DC Universe,
Infinite
Infinite,
Universe.
and then Ultra's the one that you more all the
So,
content, yeah.
I don't think that the solo issue is available on there. I couldn't find it digitally, so you might have to get one of like if you have the Ultra, you can read this in trade or something, or one of the trades that we have. It's a fun story. It's one of those things where you just have to accept the premise that this single bachelor in his mid to late 20s is going to go on a camping trip by himself with three underage boys, and we don't need to look askance at that. There's certainly nothing that would bother Dr. Frederick Wortham about this. There's nothing like that would just make this untoward. It's like, just okay, just we're doing this thing. Just accept it, okay? The joke is there. We don't have to bite that low-hanging fruit. But as I got into it, I was like, okay, it's a fun story. We're gonna, every page, we're going to have a different kid telling his version of Batman based on these, exaggerated urban legends and stuff. The one that I thought was the most interesting, though, was definitely the second one. Where that's the kid who thinks that Batman is a black guy with like an armored suit with mechanical wings and a jetpack, and he uses this high-tech gadget. I was like, well, damn it, if that hasn't actually come true, and there is a Batman character like that now, like that's a, like I think the Lucius Fox's son, Luke Fox or something, is like that, or is he a different one? There is a Batman, like the Batwing character
Batwing,
from the New 52.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, that was a different one. Luke Fox is a different guy.
Yeah, but, he's the Signal, right, or something.
Right. Yeah, something like that. Yeah, the Batwing, I think, is actually an African, like I think from like Kenya or somewhere. I don't remember. It's been too long since I read it. But I was like, yeah, they've made this version of Batman, a black man who has a gadget-based tech suit. So I kind of found that was kind of fascinating and interesting. Also, just because of the color scheme they go with, they kind of saturate those colors in like a warmer tones. He looks red and yellow, so there's like a little bit of a Robin blending with the Batman theme in that thing. I just kind of got...
He reminded me a bit of Rocket Racer, the obscure Spider-Man character who rides
a
skateboard.
Oh, yeah.
And he's a black character. And and yeah, he's got, you know, he's from the 70s. He had an afro when he was first appeared and everything. So yeah, it high afro. So it kind of made me think of him too.
The glowing eyes in the first panel.
I think he's cool. It kind of makes me think of Batman Beyond a little bit too, with the tech suit and the wings.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
Yeah. So, and
you
course,
know what? I could also think, I mean, this is not Batman related, although it kind of sprang out of the popularity of that movie, was the TV show Mantis. You remember that?
Yeah. Yeah, Carl Lumley.
Carl Lumley, exactly.
From the Captain America movie,
right,
too.
The original.
Yeah, it does remind me of that. Yeah, Mickey, the first kid, his Batman is essentially Man-Bat in a Batman suit, which I think is interesting, with the Dracula collar. He's got X-ray vision and the ability to phase through walls. So, you know, that's kind of cool. Yeah.
No, like, he can phase through walls, but he's bigger than the city? Like, get your facts straight, kid.
Yeah, I love how they're like, you can tell they're just making it up as they go along. And and I love Frank Robbins. You know, his kid speak is just a notch better than Bob Haney's. But, you know, it's the kids are, you know, it's funny because the one kid calls the other kid like dummy or something, and Bruce doesn't comment on it. He just lets him do it. And he's like, oh, now you dummy, ain't it, Mr. Wayne? Right, Ronnie. You know, it's just like, you know, you tell that kid, you know, it's just, he is a dummy. No, this is a lot of fun. And we should mention before you go any further, you brought up, it's a little cartoony. This was kind of sort of adapted, not really, into the new Batman Adventures, which is the second version of Batman. Well, kind of technically the third version of Batman.
The concept of this was adapted.
Right.
The stories itself themselves were different, but the idea of three kids spinning tales about what they think the urban legend of Batman really is. Yeah.
Yeah. The Legends of the Dark Knight episode of the animated series. And Bruce Timm actually wasn't aware of this. He came up with this idea because he, you know, when Batman Forever and Batman and Robin came out, he was like, wow, there really are so many different takes on Batman, you know. Mm-hmm. And so he pitched that to the crew, and they're like, oh, so you mean like the Batman nobody knows? And he's like, what are you talking about? And they're like, oh, this comic story. And he's like, I never heard of it. And so he apparently didn't know. It was like a parallel development type thing. But then I think the one kid's, he describes a Batman that's very much like the first kid's. We don't see him in that story. We see a Dick Sprang, Bill Finger, Batman and Robin.
Yeah.
And then we see the Frank Miller, Dark Knight Returns Batman in that one. But he describes a supernatural, you know, bat-like creature. So, yeah, I think that definitely has some influence there. Yeah, it's the same premise, but it's not, you know, Bruce Wayne's not on a camping trip with the kids and all that. So, yeah, I thought kind of weird the kid at the end you know, that he learned this story from Willie the horse, which I'm not really sure that this kid needs to be hanging around this ex-con Willie the horse. But it's another giant Batman. So it was like, it wasn't as different from the first one as I thought, you know, they might. Nowadays, yeah, they make three completely different, Batman.
Right.
But, so.
Yeah, the third one isn't as different. I think it's more, the point of the third one is more to like show like how the criminal underworld tells stories about Batman and like make themselves sound a little bit better, because Bruce is like groaning. He's like, oh God, Willie, what are you telling these kids? Like,
yeah.
What stories are you Like I remember putting him away for however many months or something like that.
Right, yeah. So I do have a question. Was Bruce trying to convince him, to convince them that he was Batman that just showed up, or was he just saying, "Hey, I have a Batman costume and this is what it looks like," when he jumps out in costume?
That's a good question. Because, like, Bruce, how far ahead did you think about this? Were you planning on just revealing your identity to these three kids? Like, I guess there's a version of this story where they're like, wow, you really are Batman Bruce Wayne, where he's like, okay, I guess I have three new ward like sidekicks that I have to bring into, like, I gotta make a call to Alfred. It's like, Alfred, open up some of the other rooms in Wayne Manor. We've got some new beds and some new training to do, because Dick is gonna have a couple new partners when he gets home.
Yeah, he's off at Hudson University, comes in, there's three kids living there now. It's like the Bat Squad, you know. It's that's like the Cousin Oliver addition to the Batman 66, you know. So we have to boost the ratings. We have to bring in a kid, you know. Yeah, so yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. I was, you know, I hadn't really thought about that in a long time, but I've never, I mean, as many times as I've read this story, I hadn't thought of that, but it's
I
definitely a
think
question.
go no, go ahead, sorry.
No, it's definitely a question to ask, you know, what's his end game here? You know, what's he trying to prove?
I think based on the final, I think we have to assume take that he was like showing up as Batman. He wanted the kids to know that this is the real Batman and this is what he looks like so that they can get their story straight. And we'll just say, oh yeah, Mr. Wayne went into the woods to take a piss or something like that. And I just happened to show up here. And now I'm going to leave just as he's, you know, zipping up and coming back out to see you guys. We'll make that an arrangement. But the whole deal is, they saw right through that disguise. They're like, oh yeah, it is Bruce Wayne. We don't believe that's really Batman. You're just like having fun with us or something like that. So the fact
Yeah.
that they don't buy it, I think, is the reversal that we are supposed to assume that he was trying to show them that this is who the real Batman is. And that's the kind of ironic twist that they're like, whatever, that's not what Batman really looks like. You're lame, Mr. Wayne. And they go to bed.
Yeah.
And that's why he kind of has that thing. It's like, all right, well, the lesson we can learn from this is that Batman scares the guilty and the wicked and not little children.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. That's yeah, I'm sure that's what it meant. Yeah, 'cause it is kind of funny though if you think about it. But yeah, I'm sure he would be like, "My friend Bruce Wayne is busy right now," you know, something like, you know, it's just like he had me tag along to keep an eye on you, you know, or something. Yeah, I mean, yeah. So, yeah. But yeah, it's cute. It's you know, it's a nice, of course, it's got Dick Giordano art. It's very classic Bronze Age. You don't get much more classic than that. You know, he drew a lot of Batman on his own, which we'll get another story about him soon. And he inked a lot of other artists, including, of course, Neil Adams. So yeah, it looks great. You know, it's you know, I can't see modern Bruce Wayne, you know, taking kids on a camping trip. Although on Batman 66, I know there was one episode where he took Dick and some of his friends out camping, and they saw the bat signal in the sky, and they couldn't answer it because they couldn't leave the kids out in the woods by themselves or something, which I thought was a neat, like a lot of tension, like we can't do anything about it, you know. So it made me think of that. So
Well,
yeah.
today it would be he takes Dick and Jason and Tim and Damien and maybe Stephanie and maybe Carrie, and like, you know, he's got no end of Robins or sidekicks or other people in Gotham that he can, you know, the world of Batman and Gotham's protectors is now like in the, you know, double high double digits or something.
This is true. Yeah, they can have their own camp. I mean, they can,
Camp Robin.
yeah, Camp Robin or something. Yeah, we should pitch that book. Yeah, there you go. Children's that. Yeah, we should pitch that. Camp Robin. It's where all the where Dick's the like the main counselor, and all the other Robins are, you know, like yeah. I like that book, and we could even, you know, he could even like put a supernatural, scary monster Jason Voorhees type character that they got to fight in it, and mix Crystal Lake with Gotham City. Why not? You know?
And for funsies, we'll have Tom King write it, and it will be about the trauma that all of these kids can endure and how this is their therapy camp.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine if Tom King wrote a Friday the 13th movie? I mean, that would it would all be about like, I saw Kevin Bacon with an arrow come through his neck, and I can't get it out of my mind. You know, that type. You know. we really got to quit picking on Tom King on this network.
I know.
Brad, he's obviously a humongous comic writer, and here we are.
I like a lot of his stuff. Brett and I made a joke about him last night when we were recording for Brett's podcast.
Oh, Lord. Yeah, we know he's a great writer, guys, but he does like to dump on the trauma. Let's ignore the fact that no other writers ever went there, and just like let's go deep with this, you know, and let's break the toys, you know. So, yeah, but yeah, this is a lot of fun. I now do really want to pitch that Camp Robin. You know, you and I need to work on that. That's like coming soon. It could be one of those, you know, the young readers books that they
of course
they
yeah produce. Yeah I'll need to do.
Yeah, those are fun. Yeah.
All right. Our second tale, again, illustrated by Dick Giordano, but written by Denny O'Neill. This story is the classic There Is No Hope in Crime Alley, originally from Detective Comics, issue 457. Batman heads out, but not to chase down a gang of jewel thieves, as Alfred assumes. Every year on this night, Batman visits Gotham's Park Row, the area more colloquially named Crime Alley. He stops a pair of hoods from stealing a car radio and scares them into going straight. He prevents a mugging and walks the elderly would-be victim to his home. At each stop in his patrol, Batman asks the whereabouts of Leslie Tompkins. He finally finds Leslie just as she's being mugged. He takes out one of the muggers, but the other pulls a gun. The audacity of pointing a gun at Batman in this of all places, on this of all nights, fills him with blinding rage. Batman lays a savage beating on the mugger as his mind flashes back to the night 21 years ago when a gunman stepped out of the shadows and murdered his parents, Thomas and Martha Wayne. On that night, the orphaned Bruce Wayne was comforted by Leslie Tompkins. In the present, Leslie stops Batman from beating the mugger to death. She asks why he comes here every year. Batman tells her it's a memorial to the horrible event that created him. Leslie tells Batman that ever since the Wayne's murder, she has committed in her own way to making Park Row a better place. Batman thanks her for rekindling his hope in humanity. When the sun comes up, Alfred finds Batman asleep, still in costume, with a smile on his face. All right, what did you think about this one?
This is seminal Batman. You know, this is a classic. It sets up a lot of iconic moments and images that we've seen repeated in all sorts of Batman media. I mean, this is the first story that makes a big deal that Batman pays a memorial to his parents, you know, on the night that they're murdered. So, I mean, we saw Bruce Wayne do that in Batman 89, you know, I mean, it's resonated even, you know, beyond the creation, the introduction of Leslie Tompkins here, it's resonated, you know, it's deep into the Batman mythos. I mean, everybody knows Batman either visits or lays roses at the site of his parents' murder. You know, I mean, that's part of the, that's almost as much of a, as part of the Batman mythos now as the bat signal, you know, in some ways. So it's a great story. It really does hold up well. It's just a wonderful little story. And back when Batman's origin was not touched on every issue.
Yeah, you know, of course.
I'm sure it was quite special to the readers of the time.
Even, I think it's Batman Arkham City. Like, there's a side quest to go to Crime Alley to see the spot where Bruce's parents were killed or something like that. Yeah. Like that unlocks something going there. Like, all right, clearly this is a big part of his whole identity. And yeah, they brought this back in one of the animated series episodes too, this whole idea of him portraying this. Now, we must have talked about this story sort of tangentially at the beginning of this podcast, those many years ago, when we were talking about the Mike Barr and Alan Davis run, because we had that whole thing when Bruce was talking to Leslie Tompkins when Robin was shot the first time, or first of many times when he was almost killed, whatever it was. So, this is a slightly different depiction of her. For one thing, in this, she's obviously ignorant of who Batman really is. I mean, if you wanted to, maybe you could read into it that she knows who she's talking to, but at least as the dialogue is presented, it sounds like she doesn't know. She might be a little bit clueless in that respect.
I think she knows. She just doesn't want, he doesn't want her to know, so she just plays along with it.
That's a good way to read it.
That's the, and the look that Dick Giordano gives on her face in a couple panels makes me think that too, that she's kind of looking at it like, you know, like that's my take. 'Cause it's like, it wouldn't take much to say, you know, Batman, he comes here every night. What happened on this night? And who is Bruce Wayne? He's this rich guy. And, you know, but, well, Batman would need a lot of money for all the equipment he's got. You know, I mean, you know, so.
Do you have an idea, or like how many times do you think Batman's origin was depicted before this? Like really kind of fleshed out, like in the history, like.
No, I honestly don't feel like, you know, I know it was, you know, obviously in I think Detective number 33, that's when it was first shown, and they repurposed those panels for Batman number one. They changed the splash with the image of Batman behind it. And then there's I think it's Batman, is it number Batman number 47 from 1948, that's like the fleshed out origin of Batman. That's the one where he catches up to Joe Chill. But it flashes back, and that's actually getting a facsimile reprint soon. That whole
Oh, nice.
comic, and then after that, there's the first Batman story that introduces the Lou Moxon concept that he hired Chill to kill the Waynes. Beyond that, I think they touched on it. Maybe was it the 25th or 30th anniversary story? I think it was the 30th, maybe the 30th anniversary story. They may have shown it again. But yeah, there was just a handful, I think, of retellings of the origin up to this point. Isn't that crazy to think of?
Well, that was kind of my point. I was like, this was probably for a lot of people like their first introduction to the origin and to like that whole concept, because it wasn't told every single issue, every single year, every single movie, and things like that. They didn't have to rehash it. Like this was maybe a novel idea of the story to kind of tell 1976 when this came out. Like at that point, the character had only been around for 30, 35 years, 37 years or something.
I will take that back. I know they did briefly touch on it in the first Ra's al Ghul story in Batman number 232, which was drawn by Neal Adams and inked by Dick Giordano. And in fact, the image of Bruce sobbing, Dick Giordano just basically lifts that and redraws it. So I mean, Dick Giordano did that. The image of Alfred here is similar to Alfred from that same story. He did that a lot, you know, which I mean, you know, he inked it, so he's like kind of stealing it from himself, I guess, you know, so it's okay. But yeah, this is definitely something that was not, you know, every time I close my eyes, I see my parents die, and every time you open a comic book, you see Batman's parents die, you know. And I love the cover to this one. We didn't talk, you know, but it's got the silhouette of, it's got Batman's head, and inside's the image of, you know, young Bruce and the Waynes, you know, there's it. It's probably the first time that the murdered Waynes were shown on the cover of a comic, because the Batman number 47 that I mentioned, that's got Bruce like reading a headline in the foreground that they were murdered. So this is the first cover that shows the image of the Waynes, and of course, you know, I think of Batman number, you know, 404 with the Mazzucchelli with them in the spotlight. This is a, you know, kind of similar scene, but it's, you know, inside Batman's head. I like how you see Joe Chill, or, you know, the murderer, running off
Yeah, I
in the
love the image,
background.
that cover, and they sort of redo it again for the splash in the beginning. It's a great image. I've always liked that.
I never noticed before, if you look at the splash, if you look closely, you can see the silhouette of the two guys who are going to rob Leslie back there, hovering around behind in one of the doorways. Yeah, I hadn't noticed that before, so that was kind of a nice little touch.
I like that. I like the idea for the story. I like the grandiose adventures of Batman fighting his rogues gallery, Batman going on jet-setting international adventures to fight, you know, Ra's al Ghul or the Court of Owls, or you know, the fighting the Joker or the Scarecrow in a Zeppelin full of fear toxin or something like that. Those are the grand operatic superhero adventures. But as we say, there's a Batman for all seasons. Like there's also a version of Batman that is just very street level that comes back to this place every year to kind of pay tribute but to also kind of remind, the pickpockets and the petty criminals and the carjackers and everything. It's like, hey, you get straighten out, go turn right, or you're going to have me to deal with. And I like this Batman too, the guy who's more grounded and on the, literally boots on the ground and taking out these kind of street criminals, but also not doing it maliciously. He gives them an opportunity to redeem themselves, to go straight, until the one guy just triggers him, like kind of like pun intended, triggers Batman and kind of sends him over the edge, and he almost, crosses that line. But it's a version of Batman that is not psychotic and is not like uber everything prepared. So it's a human Batman. It's a human Batman.
Yeah, and I like that, O'Neill in this story points out the people are kind of perplexed, why are you here worrying about petty crime, Batman? I thought you were a bigger deal, which is like, that's kind of become, Batman's on patrol constantly stopping things like this. But that wasn't necessarily the case back then. It was more, he answered the bat signal and he was, solving whatever crime, big crime that the rogues were committing or whatever. So yeah,
When
I
the
like
cops were stumped, they brought in Batman, yeah.
right, exactly. I do love that, Denny O'Neil writes the best tough guy Batman lines. That guy's got a knife and Batman says, "Your choice, punk. Drop the knife or have it crammed down your throat sideways." I mean, it's like, ow, damn,
I don't think you had to turn it up that level. Like the threat of the knife down the throat is already enough.
Right. I mean, but just like, ooh, jeez, Denny. Of course, Denny, he talked about, he was mugged. That's one reason why, I think repeatedly, that's one reason why he wrote these type of Batman stories, So I do think it's funny. We've brought this up before that Denny can, his Batman can be kind of brusque with his family, with Alfred and Dick,
Oh, sure,
and
yeah.
he's a pretty big jerk to Alfred, like, mind your own business. It's kind of like, I know Alfred says he gets agitated every year. And again, I know Alfred in this version did not raise Bruce. He showed
Yeah.
up at the house, at Wayne Manor later and discovered they were Batman and Robin, as seen in the Untold Legends of the Batman, Treasury Edition that you can probably still get on the shelves. But, it wouldn't take much for Alfred. He's an amateur detective, right? To look up, well, what
Right.
happened on this date? Oh, that's why Master Bruce is so agitated on this particular night every year.
Yeah. He should probably know a little bit about that anniversary.
Yeah, you'd think that, like, Dick or, would maybe Dick doesn't know. Hell, I don't know. Maybe Bruce doesn't tell him these things in this,
It would
but
be in the papers.
yeah, but right. I mean, Vicki Vale figured it out, right?
Vicky Vale.
She
Sure,
followed
yeah.
Bruce Wayne foot in the movie, and there, I said Vicki Vale for you.
Vicky Vale.
But
Thank you.
she saw him put the roses down, and what she went back to the files at the newspaper and said, "Oh, Bruce Wayne's parents were murdered on the street where he put the roses down," which of course probably comes from this story. So we're full circle here. So
Yeah, you're right. This Alfred doesn't have the same paternal relationship, the same like fatherly. This is much more of his employee. Like
yeah.
this is you can kind of like see, okay, yeah, like this is sort of Tony Stark telling Mrs. Arbogast to shut up while he goes do his own thing. Kind of like, all right, yeah, they don't quite have the same, loving relationship that they'll have, in later versions of Batman, but
Yeah, I do like that. Despite the fact that Batman's such a tough guy, he takes the time to walk the guy back home that he saves from the Switchblade guy.
yeah, no, that was good.
Yeah, that's cute. Yeah, that's really sweet. Yeah, I like that. And I like, of course, Leslie here isn't a doctor, as Mike Barrowmaker, and they pick up on the animated series, which, like you mentioned, it was adapted. This story was the basis of the episode, Appointment in Crime Alley, which is basically Batman's trying to get to his nightly, visit with Leslie. Who knows he's Batman in that? She knows he's Bruce Wayne in that version. She's like the modern Leslie, but he gets involved in Roland Daggett, the greedy corporate tycoon that's involved in criminal, just like
He's
all,
blowing up all the buildings just to
yeah.
for like a real estate land grab or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and she gets caught up in the middle of it. So it's and that episode's actually written by Jerry Conway. So
Oh,
Yeah,
nice. Yeah.
another great comic writer. It's a great episode, but yeah,
It is. Yeah.
it's a really of the early, very early animated series. It's one of the better episodes. Yeah,
And
but
I always loved those episodes too, the ones that didn't feature the normal costumed rogues that were just Batman dealing with kind of real crime. Those were sometimes some of the great ones because they often, a lot of those had more character development and kind of more fleshing out Batman psychology because they didn't have to worry about the criminal psychology. So, yeah.
You're right. Exactly. I like those too. All the It's Never Too Late, and
Never
those
Too Late is
episodes,
one of my
like,
favorite
yeah,
ones.
that's a great one with the gangster and his priest
Yeah.
brother, and
Paging the Crime Doctor was a good one, sort of in that same vein.
Leslie's in that one. Yeah, that's a good one too. Yeah, and I like Appointment in Crime Alley. I watched it again last night, and I'd kind of forgotten. I knew it was in one episode, but one of Daggett's main thug in that episode looks like Robert Mitchum. They You can clearly tell they based him on. It's like, oh, hard boiled, tough guy. Okay, Robert Mitchum. So it's like, yeah, that's great. Yeah. I gotta say, there's sometimes you see a page in a comic book, and you're like, wow, whoever owns that owns like one of the best. But the page 10. With Batman in the corner throwing that punch, and then the origin of Batman, the death of the Waynes, and Leslie comforting him. That if you had to own one Batman page, it's like, okay, this is Batman. This might be it. So whoever owns this page of original comic art, good on you.
Yeah, that would be amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, I like to think that Leslie kind of knows, that. Just that's invite, but Alfred didn't know apparently. So maybe that's, I think comic book characters back then, there was a suspension of disbelief that just secret identities fogged everyone's mind. You didn't have to have the hypno glasses as featured in Superman, right? So I think maybe that's just played into that trope. So maybe she didn't know, but in my head canon, I'm saying she probably knew. She just doesn't let on because he doesn't want her to know. So.
If you look at the very last panel on the last page of the story, Bruce is sleeping, and as Alfred comes in and kind of like watches it, Batman is both sitting down in a chair and smiling in his sleep. And in my headcanon, Dan DiDio saw that picture and went, "Bullshit. We're never going to allow that to happen."
There you go.
Batman does not sit and he does not smile ever.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. And he's not going to kiss some old lady on the forehead either. Yeah. I love that. And we also learned that Batman's favorite breakfast is Eggs Benedict. So you can
There
add
you
that to the spreadsheet of superhero culinary favorites. We've got beef bourguignon for Superman, veal marsala for Supergirl, and we know Dick Grayson loves Dr. Pepper. So I.
Let me ask you this. Does anybody actually like Oliver Queen's chili, or is that just a thing?
Don't know. My buddy Scott McCullough, who we were in the same like comic group at one point, and he's got his own comics he does and stuff. Great guy. He actually wrote some stuff for DC back then. He did the Green Arrow chili recipe that was in, I think,
Oh.
JLA Secret Files or Green Arrow Secret Files.
Sure,
And it showed like Martian Manhunter going, "It's too hot, I'm on fire," or something like that. So Scott like actually created the Oliver Queen chili recipe. So
Nice.
I tend to think it's good if Scott created it. So
Sure, we'll have to find it, yeah. That's cool.
yeah. This is, I mean, yeah. I think this one definitely, this comic definitely deserved to be in the greatest Batman stories ever told. That's for sure. I mean, it's and like I said, it is so. It has become so important. I mean, yes, the characterization of Leslie has changed. Mike Barr wrote her. I think the first time anybody touched on her again was in The Player on the Other Side, which was the Batman special that Barr wrote, that
That's Mike
Michael
Golden,
Golden
yeah.
illustrated. Great, great story. And there she was, this Leslie still the Earth One Leslie, but, and I, maybe I have to go back and reread that one. I haven't read it in a long time, but I, she didn't know he was Bruce Wayne there either, I don't think. And I think there was probably more, I have to see if that my theory still holds up if I read that story. But have we ever covered that? I don't think we ever have
We
we?
have not. It's been on the list of we've got to get to this at some point, so I'm
Yeah,
sure
we need to do that. That was
we'll make a big deal of it.
Yeah, that was one of those that was like, Barr was really, he did that Batman Annual that was with Ra's al Ghul that was drawn by
Yep.
Trevor Von Eden. That's a great one.
That's also on my list of books that we have to get to at some point, which I found out Diablo Frank really liked that story. I was like, that's the one thing, like, Frank likes a Batman story, but he mentioned he really liked that one, that annual with Ra's al Ghul and the Cult of the Crimson Sun or whatever it was. Yeah.
Yeah, I always remember as a kid, I remember that the ending of that. And because, Batman basically, spoiler warning, lets Ra he pulls a Batman Begins and lets Ra's al Ghul die. He's not, I'm not going to save you, but I'm not going to kill you, but I don't have to save you. And at the end, like Talia, like slaps him and walks away. And Robin's like, you lost the girl, Batman, but you saved the Gotham. Isn't that something? He's like, no, chum, that's everything. Let's go home. And they swing off. And I was just like, I always remember that. It's like, yeah. It's just like one of those cool, like comic moments when you're a kid and you read it and you're like, this is really, oh, this is like next level. We
Yeah.
didn't use that term next level back then, but it's like, this is like a better Batman story. It's just like, you just felt like it was special, So, and it's like, he called him old chum, so, which we know Mike Barr liked to do. So, the well-rounded Mike Barr Batman that's not above using a thug for a human shield, but also calls Robin old chum.
Yeah. And as we remember, and as we talk about a lot, is also just very casual in his discussions with prostitutes. I love that about Batman too.
Yep. Rhonda, was that her name? Is that
I
it?
think so, Roxy, or something like
Roxy,
that.
Roxy. Yeah, it's like, oh, that's sorry. My sister. That's my sister's name, Rhonda. But
I'm not going to read anything into that.
I don't. No. Yeah. But this was a lot of fun. I'm glad we got to cover this one. And I think it's we. I think we said all we can say about it. It's a
I think
classic.
so. Yeah. All righty, folks. We're going to take a quick break right now to play some promos. You might even hear our brand new promo on this episode for our own show. So that'll be a little bit of self-indulgence and self-promotion. But once we do that, we will come back with some listener feedback for the last five episodes, wherein we covered World's Finest issues 1 through 5. Stick around.
Hello, how are you? This is Sean Merrick from the podcast Worst Collection Ever, where myself and my wife, Jennifer Stansfield Merrick, talk about the weird, the funny, and absolutely insane comic books in our comic book collection. Are they good? Probably not, but we're going to have fun anyways. We took a little break, but now we're back with brand new episodes, so please check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, even check us out on YouTube, AngryHero79. You can subscribe, you can review, you can rate on there, and we would love to hear from you. So check you then.
Batman Nightcast is back with new episodes every month.
This time, we're covering the Dark Knight stories we overlooked in previous iterations of this show.
Anyway, I'm Chris Franklin.
And I'm Ryan Daly.
Join us as we find our joy with Batman Comics chronicling the Caped Crusader's first adventures with the Boy Wonder.
Thrill as we review the fiendish plots of a who's who of villains like Poison Ivy, Killer Croc, Gentleman Ghost, and Clayface 3.
If this is a bit, I don't understand it.
Hey kids, comics by legendary creators Don Newton, Neil Adams, Marshall Rogers, and Bill Sienkiewicz.
Plus, the single greatest Batman story ever told.
It all comes back to Batman Nightcast.
I don't know what's happening right now.
New episodes every month.
Batman Nightcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Wanna make something of it?
Did you fall on your head? Okay, we're back, and now we're going to cover feedback from the last five episodes. As Ryan said earlier, these are where we covered World's Finest. Oh, sorry, Batman Superman World's Finest, issues 1 through 5, the first story arc by Mark Waid and Dan Mora. James Williams writes in, sorry I'm late to the reunion, but things have been absolutely bonkers since the last Batman family reunion. He may be confused. Aunt Harriet was kidnapped. Turns out two of the bad uncles were secretly supervillains and part of some secret society. Batman was in outer space with the Justice League, so I had to call on two old bad uncles for help. One was Earth 2 Robin, and the other was the love child of Roy Thomas and Max Allen Collins. They were both really bizarre. And there's more if you want to read it all, but it's very funny. Yeah. So thanks, James, for playing into the switchover from from Batman Frambler Union.
I will concede this comment was like so deep and so straight that it took me way too long to figure out he was joking. Like I was like, this isn't a trolling comment. It's not spam, but what podcast does he think he's responding to? Like, is this like, and finally I was like, oh, I was like, when I got it, I was like, all right, nicely done. Nicely done.
Yeah. When he got to Earth 2, Robin and Roy Thomas and Max Allen Collins,
that was
like,
the, that should have been the tip. It was the, I had to read it like a second time. And when I got to that point, I was like, nice. Well played.
Well, you know, Roy Thomas can take credit for creating you. So there you go. Mm-hmm.
Also from episode 38, talking about the first issue of Batman Superman World's Finest, we got a comment from Paul Keen, who also on the Fire and Water Podcast Network also has some experience podcasting about Batman. He said, I agree. It would be amazing to see what Mark Waid could have done over the last 20 years at DC. His love of the characters and the world just shines through. He doesn't always hit, see, Underworld Unleashed and even the more recent Absolute Power. But man, does he understand the characters.
Agreed. I think his batting average is still very, very good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sean Ross, also from our network, who knows a thing or two about at least Wonder Woman, writes in, says, like you, I love the bold choice to make Bats and Superman actual friends and have Bruce's superpower not be super dickery. The DC universe is a better place when they are buddies. I also loved your point about Robin being the third member of the World's Finest. Dick Grayson is the greatest character in comics, and it's wonderful to see him as Robin again. Yeah, well, we might be discussing Mark Waid's take on Dick Grayson and Robin a little bit more. So,
Bucky 749 said, here is my secret question. Bucky loves the secret questions. Said, Jimmy has had a lot. He's talking about Jimmy Olsen, obviously. Jimmy has had a lot of transformations. Which do you believe is the best one? In response to this comment, Siskoid reminded us that he wrote 75 pieces on Jimmy Olsen over at Siskoid's blog of Geekery. I have not gone through all 75, but yeah, it's got to be the Turtle Boy. It's got to be Giant Turtle Boy, right? That's
right.
Yeah, I take that back. My favorite Jimmy Olsen transformation is as Sexy Womanizer from the movie that just came out last month that we talked about. That version of Jimmy Olsen is the best.
I am so on board with that, the Max, HBO Max series we discussed where it would be this Skyler, what's his, I can't think of that. I'm going to murder his last name. The actor that plays Jimmy, who was fantastic. Mm-hmm. Him as Jimmy going through all his weird transformations, you know, Werewolf Jimmy, Giant Turtle Boy, Porcupine
Plastic
Jimmy.
Boy or Elastic
yeah,
Boy, whatever.
Elastic Boy, Elad, yeah. And, Flame Bird, you know, I definitely want to see him in Corn Sweat as Nightwing and Flame Bird. That's
and the one where he just got fat. Like, that was one of his, like, he just got fat. Like,
yeah. Okay. Every DC character, Superman, Flash, they all got fat in the Silver Age. You know, it's just like, it's like traumatized, you know, a generation. But yeah. So yeah. Yeah. But I think Turtle Boy. Yeah. Turtle Boy. Some guy named Rob Kelly writes in, you guys were practically giddy at the top of the show. I can only assume it was the years of pent-up frustration not being able to talk about Batman comics you enjoy. Well, yeah, that'll do it, you know, so. And then David Ace Gutierrez, who is the flame bird to Rob's Nightwing, writes and says, I'm swooning. So glad you guys are back. I need to read this World's Finest comic, don't I? Well, yeah, you do. What are you doing, Gutierrez? Quit talking about toys with us and start reading as comic books.
Or do both. You can do both.
You can do both. Yeah, yeah.
Martin Gray from the blog Too Dangerous for a Girl said, welcome back, lads. It's great to hear you both in perky mode. Thank you very much. We love being perky on the show. Yeah. Martin said, I did enjoy the Doom Patrol appearance, but for goodness sake, Mark Waid, you needed someone with experience in strange transformations in a Superman comic and didn't give us Professor Phineas Potter? I mean, when did that Fruit Loop Niles Calder ever successfully change anyone back to normal? Fair point.
Yes.
Yeah. Martin concludes saying, welcome back to DC Comics, Ryan. I loved hearing about how you are sharing stories with Reese. Has he tried Scooby-Doo Team-Up? Yes, we have actually read the first couple issues of that. And I just, when going through this comment, I was like, oh, that was a good idea. So I have started reading some of those to him. He also asks, does Angela have an equivalent interest she's sharing with the wee fella? Yes, they do gardening and stuff like that. Like recent, like for all of his like, he's very much like online and obsessed with like YouTube, but he's also like really interested in nature and plants and animals and stuff like that. And Angie and him like will go out and like pot plants and do stuff like that. That's really kind of fun. I like to watch that.
That's great. That's awesome. Yeah. I love Scooby-Doo team up. That was something that I used to read to Danny and then she started reading them. She's got like the whole run of it. So
we just read the one with, Scooby and Ace the Bat Hound teaming up together, which, you know, given how much Reese loved crypto, that was an obvious mark for that story.
Oh yeah, sure. And you know, lest we forget, there was a DC Super Pets movie a few years ago, animated movie.
That's right. Maybe he might not remember that. Maybe he was too young when he watched that the first time. But yeah, Crypto was the star of it. Yeah.
Right. And Ace is in it too. Ace, it's a cute movie. I liked it. Yeah.
It was fun.
Yep. Tim Price from the Outcasters on the Right On Podcast Network wrote in to say, among other things, but here's the thing for me. I'm reading it digitally on the DCUIUIO, and if I had bought it physically, I would have reread each arc when it completes, but I haven't found the time to do that, and I'm not sure if it's because they're digital or I simply don't have time anymore. The second read really cements the issues into long-term memory, so I feel like a lapsed fan for not doing so. Am I alone in this? Your show is just what I need for an excuse to give these issues the reread they deserve. Yeah, I think there's something to be said if you don't read. If you have the physical copy, I think you kind of, you know, if you're like me, you kind of flip. Well, it's cord. If it's a storyline that I'm like really invested in, I don't want to spoil it for myself. I won't flip through it. I'll just read it. But then I'll go back and flip through it and, you know, kind of examine the panels. I feel like when you read it digitally, I don't examine as closely. I know Shag does that panel by panel thing, which I don't do. But so I guess it's your mileage may vary. But how do you feel about it, Ryan?
No, I definitely feel like, and especially given like the last 6 or 7 months, however, been like just reading so much digitally and speed reading through, just try and gobble up as much content as I could. There's definitely things that I've forgotten immediately afterwards, that it doesn't sink in. It doesn't permeate as much in the memory as like if you really kind of sat and held it in your hand and digested the physical copy, then I think there's something else to it. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff that I've read that I would like to reread too, especially from this run. That's why I keep thinking, because they're cheaper on in-stock trades, I keep thinking I should start collecting this World's Finest run in trade, because I know like Reese will want to read the whole series at some point, and I'd like the physical copies. Moving on now to our comments from episode 39. This is when we covered issue 2 with our special guest, Paul Keen. Got a comment from Eric, who said, another excellent episode. It took on a bittersweet quality at the end when you were discussing the possibility of a Peter David run on a Batman title. Given the present tense references to him, I'm assuming that this was recorded before his recent untimely passing. I agree that he could have done excellent work on Batman. He did write the novelization of Batman Forever, though I haven't read that, so I don't know how much of his own style he might have added to the source material. And an outstanding Penguin Commissioner Gordon story from Showcase 94, issue 7, with Batman only showing up in the last few pages. And I'm sure he must have had Batman show up for guest appearances in some of the other DC titles he wrote, though I can't recall for certain. It's a tremendous missed opportunity that he didn't write more with the character. I responded to him right away when he wrote this. I think we recorded our episode with Paul 10 days maybe before we got the news that Peter David passed away. Certainly it was like the timing of when the episode dropped was after that. But yeah, and then interesting, because he also mentions the Batman Forever novelization. If you want to hear more about that, check out a recent episode of the Overlooked Dark Knight podcast where Michael Bailey and Andy Leyland talk in great length about both the movie, and then another episode they talk about the novelization.
Mm-hmm. Those are great episodes. Yeah, I really enjoyed those. And in fact, it made me watch Batman Forever again. I hadn't watched it in a long time, and Danny had never seen it. And I'm like, have you ever watched Batman Forever? And she's like, no. And I was like, you want to watch it? And she's like, sure. She's watched pretty much every Batman movie except that and Batman and Robin. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, now this is a little different. But she enjoyed it. She thought it was less. She's like, it's very 90s. That's what she's like. Yeah. You know, like, yeah, it's very of its time, but it's It's fun. Batman and Robin, I'll be interested to see what she thinks of that when we get to it. So, Bucky 749 writes, here's a secret question. Always with the secret. Is Bucky 749 the Riddler? You know, or is he going to be the Riddler? I mean, we might be like making a supervillain here. If a member of one of your favorite bands from your childhood wrote a comic of your favorite superhero, would you buy and read? And who would it be and what hero? Well, off the top of my head, the one that I thought that made the most sense is I'm a big fan of the Eagles. Yeah, screw you, Big Lebowski. I love the Eagles. screw you, dude. Don Henley, you know, was big on, you know, environmentalism and always talking about Walden Woods and Thoreau and everything. So it made me think, well, he could write a Swamp Thing story. I'm not like a humongous Swamp Thing fan, but mm-hmm. I could see Don Henley writing a Swamp Thing story. So I'd read that.
The second part of his questions are, would you buy and read and who would it be? So, okay, let's take, for instance, the possibility that Huey Lewis wrote Mark Silvestri's Cyber Force. Would I buy that? Would I be interested in that? I don't know that would sway me. I don't necessarily know that, like, my favorite band member or musician writing a comic. I don't. Yeah, sorry, Bucky. I'm not like, I don't know that would have any kind of factor on whether or not I would be interested in this book.
Yeah. And the second time Huey Lewis came up in this episode, because we talked about Hip to Be Square.
So. There you go. I guess I know what music I'm playing at the end.
That's right.
Super Captain said, one thing that I thought was interesting is the use of the Devil Neja. Batman Superman World's Finest came out almost concurrently with Jean Lun Yang's Monkey Prince limited series. Monkey Prince is derived from the Chinese epic Journey to the West, and Neja is taken directly from that work as well. Given that Yang and Wade wrote the Lazarus Planet event together, I wonder if they were already talking at this point. In any event, all of that inspired my wife and I to take a deeper dive into Chinese mythology and read Journey to the West. I was already typing out my comment when you asked the question who you'd like to see or have seen write Batman. I was thinking to myself, oh, Mark Gruenwald, and that'll be someone that no one else will mention. And then Chris Franklin said, Mark Gruenwald. I'll stick with that answer anyway. Yeah, good comment, good question. I haven't read much of Monkey Prince. I did read one or two issues that tied into that Lazarus Planet thing. Like that was one like that came out during my absence from DC, and I had no idea who that comic. Like I'd never heard of Monkey Prince. I was like, what is this thing? And then I read an issue. I was like, this is pretty good. I might have to look more into this when I get the chance.
Yeah, I have never tried it. I was out. I didn't get the Lazarus Planet series. I've got to, I guess, go back and read that at some point too. So, yeah, yeah. And Mark Gruenwald, yeah. Great minds think alike, you know. So, well, I mean, kind of Nightfall just basically redid the Captain America story, the John Walker story. Sure, you know, why not? again, this guy, Rob Kelly, writes in, I don't have much to say about the issues being discussed. I will offer a question for the what Batman story would you like to see adapted into live action question. My answer would be from World's Finest number 269, where a relatively common crook managed to knock Batman out and bury him alive in a coffin. Superman goes on a frantic search to find him, but Batman has to figure it out alone by using only his wits. I think a sequence like that in the middle of a Batman movie would be amazing. Oh, yeah, that's a great story. I remember that issue. Robin's in that story too, and he doesn't get a lot to do, but he is in it. So yeah, that's a graphic. That is that Jerry Conway and Rich Buckler, I think, maybe?
I think so, because I actually covered that issue with Rob on, I think he had me as a guest. Maybe it was just an episode of Find Your Joy on FW Presents. I don't think it was Mountain Comics, but yeah, I remember Rob covered that story and I was his guest on that one. And I remember having the same thought. I was like, this is a great premise, like for all of Superman's power, to just have somebody trapped in a lead-lined coffin and he can't save them. He can't find them that way. He kind of reduces Superman's power to next to nothing, kind of like what we saw with Krypto being taken off the board in the movie. And like you could do that with Lois or with Batman or anything. And then if Superman is compromised by having to try and find the woman that or the person that he loves, could he be used or exploited by the villain? There's a ton of drama you can get just from that basic premise. So, yeah, I think that would make a great movie.
Mm-hmm.
Martin Gray said, as our terrible trio noted, Wade and Mora are next level in their skills. While I'm giving out compliments, Tamara Bonvillain and Aditya Bidiker deserve praise for their sterling work on Colors and Letters. Bonvillain always lights for location, and the hues are especially when we're with Dick and Kara up in the sky in China. Bidiker shrinks the text to indicate whispering and goes square for Robot Man's dialogue, avoiding full-on cliched computer font.
Nice, yeah. That's the type of things you take for granted, but when it's not good, you're like, oh, you know. But
Yeah, exactly.
Good point. I'm glad he called them out. Yeah. Nate the Great writes in to say, these Mark Waid World's Finest Stories are great, though I don't think Robin and Supergirl would last long as a couple. Be more fun to see her with Wally West, Kid Flash, or Roy Harper, Speedy. Oh, don't put her through that with Roy. Come on. Too bad we didn't get more Peter David Batman. I would like to see Jeremy Adams get a crack at Batman. He writes Green Lantern and Aquaman now, and also did that Scooby-Doo Supernatural team-up. Could you guys do Batman 310 and 319, the Lin Wein Gentleman Ghost issues? Well, that's a thought. I don't know if I could, I don't want to hear it from the Gentleman Ghost, though, you know, because if we cover those, that's all he's going to yak about, and I got to get House of Frankenstein recorded. I ain't got to want to listen to him, you know, just going on about how he's in the comic or how they didn't treat him right. You know, he gets all torn up about it. So,
so the answer is yes, we will definitely cover those issues. Just to make Chris have to deal with that. No, we'll get to them at some point. I like those issues. So we'll find a way to.
I remember I bought that. I don't think I had 310. I think I bought 319 off the stand, and I'm like, oh, this is a guy that was in that Super Friends episode, because he was in, like, the one-off Super Friends episode. I thought he was just, like, most of those characters made up for the show, and nope, there he was, so, yeah.
I gotta say, the Supergirl Woman of Tomorrow, that version of Supergirl, she would definitely go out with Roy Harper.
Oh, yeah, she definitely would.
It would be a disaster, but it would be an explosive disaster, yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of, Ange from the Supergirl blog Comic Box Commentary said, without a doubt, the Supergirl Robin stuff in this book is top-notch fun. The way she is carrying him shows just how icy the whole thing is. And I love that we get to see all of the insanity they mention in a later issue. Yeah, their whole date and the disaster that turned out to be is depicted in a future issue, which is a lot of fun.
We might have to cover that one.
We might have to get to that one.
Yeah, I think that would be fun. Get Dr. Ange back for that one. That'd be great. Yeah. Tim Price returns to say, Batman story for the movies. I have a soft spot for 10 Nights of the Beast, and with some tweaking, it could be a great movie. An assassin targeting high-profile people in Gotham City, and it takes Batman and Robin to stop him. Put some diversity into the supporting characters, get rid of some dated stereotypes, and it could be a winner. Oh, yeah, that would be... That would be a good story. That's a fun nail biter of a story. And then you can have Batman, you know, just leave him down in the sewer and to die again, you know. So
I mean, if you didn't want to do the whole Russia connection with a KG Beast, they could use like Deadshot and thing if you wanted to somehow bring Will Smith back, if that had been a viable option. Idris Elba's Bloodsport, kind of in the same type of role. You can do something like that. There's certainly alternatives, but yeah, a KG Beast type of story, that would also, I think James Gunn would have a lot of fun with that idea of just like that type of character. On episode 40, we covered Batman Superman World's Finest number 3 with our guest Paul Hicks from DCOCD. Brett Young said, I always love hearing from our friends in the exotic planet of Australia. I continue to enjoy the coverage of this incredible World's Finest series. I love the comparison of Dan Mora to JLGL, PBHN. Mora is quickly climbing the ranks of my all-time favorite comic artists. Okay, I'll have a thing about that in a second, but I would love to have seen John Buscema do a Batman run. I think he would have killed it. Well, naturally, he would have killed everything. We have to mention, though, this was... I think we both had some conflicting thoughts about this. Dan Mora is taking a break from DC Comics now. He's not doing Justice League or World's Finest anymore. Starting in October, I think Dan Mora is going to be the regular pencil on Skybound's Transformers comic, starting with issue 25, written by Robert Kirkman. Now, that is certainly a loss for DC, but the fact that he would take that, like, just like leave like Superman, Batman, and pretty much any project he wanted at DC to draw Transformers, that's got to be a passion project for him. So I'm really excited to see what he does with that.
Yeah, that's true. Even though I'm sure Rob's like, he's leaving to draw boxes, you know.
But he'll make them look like such cool boxes. He's so good.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be fantastic. Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
He's also not under exclusive to Image or Skybound, so I'm sure he'll do more stuff. He'll spread himself around. But
yeah, I know he drew some of the covers for the Batman Deadpool crossover series that's coming out.
Yeah.
Okay, episode number 41 was Batman Superman World's Finest number 4 with our special guest, Dr. Ange. Paul Keehan from this very network wrote in, "Please, no more said about Comet the Super Horse. When I was a kid, I was completely grossed out by that and Supergirl kissing a horse. As an adult, it doesn't get any better. Yuck." Sorry, I think I'm the one that brought that up. So, yeah, sorry about that, Paul. It is very strange.
Noah Tarnow said, "Chris, you beat me to the punch. As soon as Ange mentioned wanting to see Killer Moth in live action, I wanted to speak up about that Batgirl promo video featuring a discount store version of the villain played by Tim Herbert, who appeared in Soylent Green and The Boston Strangler, among a lot of other TV films and shows, Seriously, he might take the cake as worst-looking villain in all of Adam West Batverse. He makes the bookworm and the minstrel look dignified. I'd love to see the Moth in modern live action. There's a lot to play with there. He's been depicted as a weirdo badass, an insecure loser, and even the first of the many anti-Batman. In his debut appearance, he distributed Moth signals to crooks so he could come help them when they're in danger. A skillful screenwriter could make a great story using all of those concepts. I have trouble distinguishing all of the various Supergirl costumes, though I'll always remember the Crisis-era headband, and I'm suitably grossed out when she wears what amounts to low-cut miniskirt. I'm remembering a house ad from the early 2000s in which you could literally tell that she shaves in a certain sensitive area. Yeah. Mora depicts her perfectly, both ass-kicking and cute, in equal measure, though he makes all women look cute, and if I must say, his Rita Farr is my new comics crush."
Super Captain wrote in to say, "As far as live-action Superman villains, Brainiac is the obvious choice, but I wouldn't mind seeing a film with Mr. and Mrs. Pidlick involved in some way, either as a main antagonist or general nuisance, not to mention Metallo and Terra Man." Well, Super Captain, I hope you saw Superman, because you can kind of infer that what the Justice Gang is fighting while Superman and Lois are having their heart-to-heart is Mrs. Pidlick. So it's a interdimensional imp, so there you go.
Rob McCarthy said, "Don't like Hal being mind controlled." That was it. Okay, well, I agree.
And you must not have liked a lot of the comics from the past. Parallax, you know. Jeff Johns, when he revealed that, I guess, but you know, so that was better than him, you know, just willy nilly killing everybody out of character. But anyway. Mark Baker Wright writes in, "There was a comment about folks not being okay with Kyle Rayner's will being overpowered by Deathstroke, while the basic consensus was that it was okay to have Hal's willpower overcome if Superman and Batman joined their wills together. While I can concede a certain logic to this opinion, I'm not sure I agree. While I have no doubt that Kyle's willpower is generally strong, once one accepts that Kyle wasn't really chosen to be Green Lantern because of his willpower in the same way that most other Lanterns are, I don't see it being too much of a stretch to suggest that Deathstroke is known to have more use of his brain, and from here I extrapolate willpower, than most people could overcome him, even if such a feat might well be beyond the abilities of most others." Yeah, I see what you're saying, and I don't think that, I think you're right. I don't think Kyle necessarily, if the Green Lantern standards were up to what they usually were, would Kyle have ever become a Green Lantern? Possibly not, you know, and right, that's no right. offense to Kyle Rayner fans. It's just, right. you know, that they just had, you know, they had to have no fear and willpower and all that stuff. So
he was much more in the Marvel vein of just being in the right place, right time to get his superpowers rather than,
right.
you know, like kind of earning it because of some, you know, version of his personality or his soul.
So. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. And yeah, the whole, I mean, that whole thing, Deathstroke takes out the whole Justice League, kills Firestorm. Deathstroke's great,
You're misremembering that. I had to actually go back and check. Deathstroke doesn't kill Firestorm. Firestorm dies later on in that series when they're attacking the Shadow Thief, and he takes somebody's sword. Is it Silent Knight or he takes somebody's enchanted sword or whatever the Shadow Thief does and stabs Firestorm. And that's when he has to fly off and explode so he doesn't like irradiate the whole world. But yeah, it was in a different scene. It was a different scene.
I apologize then. I haven't read that story for years for reasons. So
I think you'd be forgiven for misremembering parts of that story because you blocked it out. I think a lot of our community would like to block out a lot of that story.
Yes.
Brett Young said, good discussion on Tom King's stories. I'm hit or miss on him. Most of his 12 issue runs are fine by themselves, but I don't think of these stories as being part of the regular canon, except maybe Darkseid enjoying a crudité. I do highly recommend his Superman story Up in the Sky. It was a wonderful tribute to the Man of Steel. I agree. I read that Up in the Sky story recently and, There were some really cool parts of that. Like overall, like the story, the structure of it was kind of all over the place. I think it was a digital first story, so it like kind of came out in shorter chapters, and then they were clumped into issues and then all packaged together. So the narrative is a bit wonky and like atypical and not linear, but the elements of it are good, and I like what he was trying to do with that story. Just yeah, it was a little bit different.
Was that maybe the story that was also in the Walmart 100-page giants or whatever that they put out for a while? Was that
maybe.
That story? Yeah, maybe. I know there was one that was in – I think I had some of those. I'll have to go back and read it on the DC Universe Infinite Ultra Humanite, whatever they call it. Yeah.
There's a great part of the story where he's rescuing this little girl and like they're flying across space and she's just asking him a whole bunch of questions. And it's just kind of like there's funny little bits like, so does Lex Luthor hate you because he's bald? It's like, no, he hates me because he thinks I show the world what they could accomplish. And he makes, people feel small and everything. It's like, but also the baldness. And Superman's like, yeah, he probably hates me because I made him bald. It's like...
Back to the old Superboy story. That's great.
Yeah.
That's funny. Martin Gray writes in, thank you, Ange, for the Batman Who Bores reference. How appalling to see Mark Waid use him, at least as a visual, in the current crossover between the series and Justice League Unlimited. Hey, they stuck him in the superpowers line from McFarlane. I'm like, he does not belong in this toy line. Get him out of here, right? Didn't buy him. So far as putting villains on screen who we've not seen yet. And you're fine with Killer Moth, and he did originally start out as a Batman bad guy, so much so that, in fact, he was meant to be the anti-Batman. And then Martin continues, the Batman villain I'd love to see is Nocturna, complete with evening wear and blue skin. Superman-wise, yes to Brainiac, but also, how great would Terror Man look? Chap spurs and flying horse Nova. I'd love to see Terror Man show up just for the memory of our friend Zoom Yukinori. He'd be smiling from somewhere, and if the Terror Man ever made it, especially if he just looked like the classic Bronze Age, and I could see James Gunn doing that just for a one-off villain Superman fights at the beginning of a movie or something, Nocturna, I was so done with Nocturna by the time Doug Minch got finished with his Batman run. I want nothing to do with her. That's my personal opinion. He loved her way more than anybody else did. Her and her half icky half brother, stepbrother thing, Thief of Night, Night Slayer. You can keep both of them, in my opinion. No offense to anybody who's a fan, but as a kid, I was like, oh, these guys again. Oh,
I think Sean Ross loves those guys.
Ugh.
Finally, episode 42, when we covered the fifth issue of the series with our guest Michael Bailey, Martin Gray came back and said, before you do the Mark Waid and Chris Samnee series, how about an episode devoted to Dan Jurgens and Mike Perkins' The Batman First Night, which was spectacular and is soon to get a sequel. I didn't know about the sequel, but that is a really, really good book. It was like one of the Black Label books that came out in three kind of oversized issues. I just read those a couple of months ago. It was like, I thought the premise looked pretty cool, but it took me a while to get to it. When I did, I love that book. It's set like in like 1939 or 1940 as if, You know, it's a period piece when Batman first arrives. The trappings of that, it feels like kind of like a pulp noir type of story. Like radio is a big part of it. Like you can almost imagine it as a radio drama, like the shadow or the look of it, the art and everything. It's sexy. It's funny. Deals a lot with Monster Men. I feel like the Monster Men is a bigger thing now that it keeps coming back in Batman stories recently. But I don't think we're going to get to that one yet, Martin, but I would like to cover that at some point because in terms of modern Batman stories, First Night was really, really good.
Yeah, I really need to read that. It was one of those that, you know, Dan Greenfield at 13th Dimension was really banging the drum about. And every time I went to my comic shop, the first issue was sold out. And I'm like, well, I'll catch up to it some other time. And I haven't gotten around to reading. I mean, I'm a mark for the first appearance Batman look. So I need to read that one before the sequel comes out. Cause I knew they were doing a sequel. So yeah, it looks fantastic. I definitely need to try that out.
Plus, that could be our redemption arc with Dan Jurgens after the fight that we had about the Batman v Superman movie.
We're not supposed to mention that. Remember, Rob?
That's right.
On the Treasury Cast episode. Yeah, that makes sense. Jeff Owens of the Classic Horrors Club podcast, which I guested on recently. I was a guest with him and Rich Chamberlain. We talked about The Terror with Boris Karloff and Jack Nicholson, very young Jack Nicholson. So kind of tied into Batman, I guess.
Sure.
Yeah. Jeff says, enjoyed the episode, Chris. I knew we were kindred spirits. Man Bat in a Batman movie? Yes. Of course, Jeff of Classic Horrors Club wants to see Man Bat. But so do I. Yeah.
Bucky749 said, since the subject of DC dogs came up, the Martian Manhunter had a dog in Detective Comics issue 232. In his civilian identity, he rescues a stray basset or bloodhound and names it Jupiter. Sadly, the dog doesn't appear in comics again. Maybe James Gunn could do something with it. Have the Martian Manhunter and Jupiter be canine officers. If anybody was going to remember that other than you, Bucky, I'm sure James Gunn would be the person again. Who knew who like the Ghost of Flanders was before he put him in that mural? So,
exactly.
Yeah, he's going to resurrect a non-super dog for the Martian Manhunter. That could be it, though. And then Bucky asked another secret question because that's his brand. Who is the best hero pet in the DC universe and who is the best villain's pet in the DC universe?
Well, I would say hero pet's got to be Crypto, especially now, but even before now. Yeah, I think it's Crypto. He's kind of the go-to guy.
Yeah, Dark Horse, maybe Topo?
Yeah.
Yeah, Octopus banging the drums?
Well, that's true. Yeah, Topo's good, you know, and, you know, for, you know, and you've got, you know, if you're a Super Friends fan, you've got Wonder Dog and Gleek, you know, so maybe that are for a generation of kids. But a villain, isn't there a cat, Yellow Lantern?
Yes.
Yeah.
What is his name? Bleez or something?
Yeah.
No, it's a Red Lantern.
Oh, Red Lantern. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah.
Let me double check that name because I know that was a good pull. Who's the?
I can't remember much about it, but I just remember it being kind of cool that there's this cat. Oh,
it's Dexstar.
Dexstar. Oh.
Sort of like Dexter. Yeah, serial killer, but a cat.
Yeah.
No, Bleez is a different character from Green Lantern Mythos or Lantern Corps. But yes, that was good.
Yeah, I like that one. Or maybe it's Brainiac's pet monkey, you know, that's a little pet.
That would be a good one, too. My first thought was the Harley and Joker's hyenas. Those are the first ones that I thought of.
Yeah, Bud and Lou. They're named after Abbott and Costello. Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know that. I didn't know they had names.
Yeah, yeah. They. I think in the animated series at one point they call them that. Yeah, they're named after Abbott and Costello. So.
Oh, wow. I never knew that. That's good. That's good. I like that.
Yeah.
Bud Abbott and Lou Costello. Nice.
Yeah. Paul Kien wrote in again to say, I recall when I first read it thinking, oh, Superman will take the Phantom Zone projector in, but then won't Nezha have it? The point of him trusting Batman to figure it out and release him was brilliant and cemented the excellent friendship, which I think is fantastic. Can't wait to see what's next. Yeah, exactly, Paul. That was a great way to wrap things up that Superman knew Batman had his back. Yeah, that was great.
All right, that wraps up the comments for this episode. Thank you all very much for your feedback. We love getting those. We're going to try and address feedback more often, not every episode, but maybe every three episodes or so that they don't pile up as much like this one did. But obviously, we want to get those five episodes out on time to coincide with the release of the movie. As for what comes next and... I think, we should probably cement this. I think we're kind of on the same wavelength. We're going to go back to doing two issues, and then we'll leave feedback for every, you know, third or fourth issue after that. But the next one we're going to start off with is continuing our Mark Waid love affair with Batman and Robin Year One, Issue One. So that'll be a little bit of the new. And then for the little bit of old, we're going to go back to Detective Comics 477. This is actually continuing the Marshall Rogers run that we used to. We covered the Steve Englehart part of it. But when Englehart left, Marshall Rogers stuck around for a few more issues written by Len Wein. And this is the story that introduces Clayface 3. But the first issue is kind of weird because Rogers just draws like two pages as bookends, and the middle chunk is a reprint of an old Neil Adams story. So it's kind of a funny first issue, and we'll kind of barrel through that one, and then we'll get to the Clayface 3 issues after that one.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to all of that. You know, more Mark Waid and Chris Samnee, awesome. And then we got Chris Samnee and Marshall Rogers and Neil Adams to talk about the art in the next episode. Wow. You know, that's
going to be so painful.
I can't stand to look at this. Oh my God.
if something is going to make me quit this podcast again.
Batman Nightcast is a proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network. Feedback for the show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also find Batman Nightcast and the Fire & Water Network on Facebook, Blue Sky, and other social media platforms.
If you enjoyed this episode, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcast to support Batman Nightcast or your other favorite shows on the Fire & Water Podcast Network.
As always, thank you for listening.